Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I hope you like my new professionally produced introduction that actually only costs me $15 at Fiverr.com, Fiverr.com. I'm just letting you all know I'm not getting any kickbacks or remuneration for recommending it, but it was really an easy process and I think a very professionally delivered product. So anyway, we have a great show today as always, and I'm very excited about our guest. Our guest is Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Roxanne grew up in rural Oklahoma, the daughter of a tenant farmer and part Indian mother. She has been active in the international indigenous movement for more than four decades and is known for her lifelong commitment to national and international social justice issues. After receiving her PhD in history at the University of California at Los Angeles, yay, UCLA, that's where I went, she taught in the newly established Native American Studies program at California State University Hayward and helped found the departments of Ethnic Studies and Women's Studies. Her 1977 book, The Great Sioux Nation, was a fundamental document at the first International Conference on Indigenous Peoples of the Americas, held at the United Nations headquarters in Geneva. Dunbar Ortiz is the author or editor of seven other books, including Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico. She lives in San Francisco, and today we're going to be talking about her newest book, The Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me, Cindy. I'm really happy to talk to you.
Well, it's really an honor to have you on the show today. I don't know, maybe about 6 weeks ago, I got a notification that you were publishing this book, and it just seemed so intriguing. I immediately wrote to your publisher, and I asked for a review copy. And then I asked for an opportunity to be able to interview you about it. And I did get the book, An Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States. And it is just so fabulous. It's so readable. It's so informative. It's very, obviously you know the subject inside and out, but it's also written with heart and passion, and I just really connected with it. But tell my listeners about the book and how the book came about, because that's actually a story also.
Well, thank you for your support for the book. I actually thought of you quite a bit while I was writing the book and felt this very deep responsibility to build those connections between the past and what led to your loss in perilous war. And so you were one of my inspirations.
Wow, that's just really, I just feel so amazed because I do feel like I had a personal connection with this book, and now I know that I did.
It must have come through. And I thank you for all the work that you've done to bring consciousness of these aggressive wars. And we have a lot of work to do still. And I'm hoping this book contributes to that. When it came about, it's everyone knows about Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, a real classic. Mm-hmm. And that was published in 1980 by Beacon Press, my publisher. Now, and mm-hmm. of course, Beacon Press is in Boston, and Howard Zinn was at Boston University, so they were very good friends, and the book, his book got popular, and they sold it to Penguin, and, you know, it's no longer with Beacon. But he, before he passed away, which was sudden and unexpected, but he had a talk with the editors and the president of Beacon and suggested that they do a series of revisioning American history, is what they ended up calling it. So they're doing, you know, many books in this series, and they're to be, like Howard's book was initially and still is, although it's much fatter as he added things along the way. But it started out as about the length of mine, and without too many footnotes, intimidating, and you know, was written in a way without watering anything down, written in a way that that was, you know, readable and that could be accessible to high school students or PhD students or faculty. You know, researchers, and used at every level. And so they've published two of those books in the series already, Queer History of the United States and Disabled People's History of the United States. And mine was supposed to go first, but I didn't get it done in time. Hardest book I've ever written. I got the contract, and they invited, Howard recommended that I write, that they asked me to write this book. So they asked me to write it, and I just jumped at the chance. I said, this is what, you know, I've been wanting to write, putting all this together all my life. But then when I sat down to do it, I thought, this is impossible. I cannot do it because, you know, the restrictions on the length, for one thing, and the readability, how to make a narrative that's not just this happened and then that happened and then that happened, and how to give proper respect to 500 very different Native nations in the United States. And, you know, because it is a history of the United States, and to capture a consensus. Fortunately, you know, my work with the American Indian Movement and the Native American Movement in general and the International Indigenous Movement for the last 40, well, now it's, you know, almost 50 years, I had a good, you know, pretty good grounding and sense of a consensus. Like I say in my author's note, I didn't learn this framework of history from my as a doctoral student or from any history professor I ever had. I learned it from the people and their struggles and being involved in them, and they're the ones that taught me this. So I felt on good grounding that this was a consensus perspective, although very different people. Some Native people are very right-wing Republicans, you know, libertarians. Some are, you know, very, very radical militants, but they all know the truth. You know, it's an unavoidable truth, and yet U.S. history books have managed to avoid the truth for generations and generations of even up to the present. But Native people know the truth. They may have different views of what should be done, you know, and some may say, well, we should just all assimilate, but, you know, yeah, all that did happen exactly like that. So I felt pretty good grounding, but but that was shaken sometimes, like how, you know, connecting it up, especially with the, you know, the U.S. military's formation in the base in the Indian Wars, and that the Indian Wars began when Anglo settlers first set foot on the continent, and that built the basis for the U.S. as an independent state, just continuing, you know, the process and implementing the same settler colonial policy of expansion. Even more robustly than Britain ever would have done. It actually had decided to limit Anglo settler settlers in 1754 with a proclamation that they could not move beyond those 13 colonies.
Right.
And I think that was a primary reason, which is never given in any textbook, for the independence movement, because these were, you know, these were colonialist settler slave-owning elite that made the U.S. Revolution.
Well, there's so much in this book. You did pack a lot of great information into the short, you know, the limitations of a shorter book. But what I found, first of all, I went to UCLA and I studied U.S. history, and I try to concentrate on westward expansion and California history especially, and then so then within that, you know, the course of studies, I did take some, you know, native classes, but those classes were more concentrated on the culture of the Native Americans or indigenous people, not on, but there was always hints of, you know, the indigenous struggle, the extermination. There was always hints of that, but never anything blatant. The only time it was ever blatant in my course of studies is when I studied California history, because California history actually is a microcosm of what we did, almost complete extermination of our indigenous population.
Yeah, it's hard to get around California history. And books have been actually written with titles like The Extermination of California Indians. But, you know, that's a kind of entrapment, too, because the there's been more and more of an acknowledgement of extermination. Rarely will anyone use, you know, any scholars use the term genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Although by the terms of the 1948 Genocide Convention, it fits every part of it. Every act that can be construed as genocide applies to Native Americans in North America, including removing children from the people, from, you know, taking them away, which is the federal boarding school system. Over a period of 100 years, doing that, generations and generations, losing their children, who lost their language, their culture, they're kept away for 10 whole years, and are not intended to go back, but most do go back, and then they did go back and as traumatized adults.
Right.
And so that gets passed on, that trauma generationally. And then bodily injury, but the main one is creating conditions in which a people, a group, ethnic, religious, or national group cannot continue to exist. And that's the most important thing, not how many people were killed. So I think in some ways the willingness to admit the absolute blatant truth of the very short-term, short period of time extinction process, or the attempt to extinguish all Native people and especially Northern California with the gold gold rush, admitting to that is sort of like, well, this is, you know, the most extreme example, and yes, that's bad, but, you know, that wasn't typical. So that's the argument a lot of historians make. So there's this term now being used by young Native American scholars of terminal narratives.
Mm-hmm.
That there's this new entrapment as people admit, especially on the left, they admit the genocide and condemn the United States, and then say, but that's the past. You know, we have to move on, and they don't look at how that affects the present policies of the United States, the structures of government.
Right.
Domination, and not only that, but the Native people remain colonized.
Absolutely.
They're still here. They haven't gone away. Yeah.
Well, there's like this book is a course of study, but we'll try to cover as much as we can in a 45-minute interview. But when I set up this interview, I just like realized today, because I'm just so wrapped up in the present, that when the interview comes out, it will actually be Columbus Day. So see how the universe works. But since Columbus Day is like just over a day, the day after tomorrow, what is the doctrine of discovery? And, you know, I'd like you to talk about the doctrine of discovery, but what happened with the overturning of the, what was it, a resolution that the Vatican and Spain wanted on the 500th year of, you know, right. Columbus's discovery of a land that already had millions of people?
Yes, in 1982, 10 years before the quincentenary, 500-year anniversary of Columbus, in the General Assembly, I was sitting there. We didn't have a big lobby in the UN yet. We had only started 5 years before, and hardly any in New York headquarters, because all the human rights work is at UN headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been, trying to sit in General Assembly. I had done it for, that was the third year, and just learn, you know, how that particular committee where indigenous, where, you know, the concerns of racism and human rights are taken up, the Economic and Social Committee of the General Assembly. So I'm sitting there, and it's usually, you know, pretty dull, but trying to figure out, you know, who's who, how they react to things, and who I might lobby, and how we might get a resolution. And that particular time, I was also helping out the Mayan exiles, you know, the genocide in Guatemala mm-hmm. was going on. So I was introducing them to UN people and trying to get a resolution in the General Assembly. And I suddenly heard this proposal, and it came from Spain, that the UN have a celebration in the United Nations for the quincentenary in 1992. As an encounter between cultures.
Right.
And then the Holy See, the Vatican, piped up to endorse this.
Right.
And all these different European states, you know, Norway and Ireland and France, they all started teasing each other that maybe they had, or teasing Spain that maybe actually the Vikings or the Irish or someone else had really discovered America. And it was all, you know, good fun, and it was
right.
clear they thought this thing would just go through and there'd be no problem at all. It was jocular. And suddenly, you know, everyone is seated, all these ambassadors are seated by alphabetical order of their countries. So the Africans, who are the largest bloc, are scattered. You know, they're not all together,
right.
but they work as a bloc. But usually they have to go meet in a room together to be a bloc. So I don't know how it happened. It was before texting or email or anything else. But suddenly they all rose up, and they're very apparent they were all Africans because they're black, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the sea of white. And they walked out, and they walked out. So there was this stunned silence. And then the chairman of a meeting, who was, I can't remember what country, it's a European country he was from, said, "What does this have to do with Africa?"
Oh.
You know,
oh,
boy, how clueless can you be?
Really, totally.
Colonialism and slavery. So they came back in, they took a recess, and they came back in about half an hour later, and they had met and had a statement from whoever their elected spokesperson was that year, whatever country. And his statement said that it is absolutely shameful that it should even be mentioned in the halls of the United Nations, that the onset of colonialism and slavery should be celebrated. And in an institution that was established for the purpose of decolonization. And I'm telling you, that really killed that proposal. they can't get anything through without the African bloc still today. If they do something as a bloc, so it's gone. But then, of course, they went on to celebrate, and it kind of backfired because it really mobilized Native people throughout the hemisphere, and it really advanced because we're able to get more attention than ever before about that Native people had been colonized in the Western Hemisphere. It wasn't just some tragic past in history that was no longer an issue. And then the Nobel people helped us out by making Rigoberta Menchú, the flying activist, the Peace Prize winner that year.
Right.
And announced it on October 12th, 1992, which enraged the heat.
I bet.
Oh, absolutely. And the dictatorial, there were all these dictatorial Chile and these more conservative countries even in Latin America were upset. They had all collaborated with Spain in celebrating the Quincentenary, and the U.S. and Canada did as well, except for Cuba. And Cuba paid a price for it because Spain is the main investor. And it's very important, when with the economic blockade from the United States,
right,
that Spain pulled out investments, the tourist investments. I think it's changed since, but for a time it was a very tough time in Cuba at that time, as they were having to go into this special period of losing all the socialist blockade. And it was such a courageous thing, and Fidel simply said, there are only two choices. We're either with a colonizer or the colonized. And how can Cuba be with a colonizer? So, we always remember that because it was truly a courageous act and said something, important about the Cuban Revolution. So, and why it continues to be suppressed.
I always say Viva Fidel every chance I get.
Yeah, Viva Fidel. So the doctrine of discovery is, I wanted to read a quote to you that tells you why this is so important. This is an interview in 2009, right after Obama was inaugurated president, and he was in, his Middle East speeches in Cairo and all. He was being interviewed by El Arabiya television in Dubai, and he was being pushed, rather aggressively about whether the United States could be an honest broker in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Right.
And he said that definitely the United States could be an honest broker. And this is a quote: "We sometimes make mistakes. We have not been perfect. But if you look at the track record, America was not born as a colonial power."
Well, that's
that really caught my attention.
I guess so. I don't know why they don't choke on those words.
I know. It's just like... He said that.
It's just blather at this point.
That doctrine of discovery, I think he probably, in one part of the mind, if someone said, if that Dubai reporter had said, well, how did you get from, 13 little states on the Atlantic to all over the continent and the Pacific with colonies, how did that happen?
Right. Which would have been a natural follow-up question if we had...
Everyone believes in the American myth, not just U.S. American citizens. It's worldwide. They sold this myth, so people don't ask. We really had a hard time in the United Nations. We raised a lot of consciousness, of course not with anyone from Dubai, probably, the wealthy Emirates, but certainly Palestinians understand, and activists, Egyptians and others in the Middle East understand very well because of the work we've done, and Africans, Asians. So we've done a lot of education of people, and I think internationally there's more understanding of U.S. history now than certainly than there was before. But this still, you know, that they think they can say things like that and not be challenged is, you know, it shows the work we have to do.
It's incredible.
So the doctrine of discovery is it's just taken for granted. It's not really in legal texts in law school. So, you know, lawyers simply, of course, Native Americans know it. In federal Indian law, it's taught, but that's a very, you know, specialized course in law schools that mostly only Native law students take. But it actually is still in effect as U.S. law. It comes out of, you know, it's a centuries-old doctrine. It was a canon law in 1454. It was first enunciated by Pope Urban II, that Portugal, the Christian kingdom of Portugal, mm-hmm. had the right to invade and annex West Africa to take slaves. You know, for the beginning of the slave trade, Atlantic slave trade. And so that was the first application. Then Spain, after it had had driven out the expelled, ethnically cleansed the Iberia of the Muslims mm-hmm. and Jews, which happened in, you know, the mass expulsion started in 1492, the year that Columbus sailed, they began their own, you know, North African ventures, and then, of course, Columbus himself going on this voyage, and so in 1494, they the Pope expanded the doctrine of discovery, the right to simply seize non-Christian lands anywhere Spain or Portugal went. And then it got adopted by other countries, you know, by France, and France even after it was a republic, and by the United States when it was founded. Mm-hmm. In 1792, right after the founding of the United States, the Secretary of State was Thomas Jefferson.
Right.
And he enunciated that the doctrine of discovery was international law applicable to the new U.S. government as well. And as many things with Jefferson, he built the architecture for what was later implemented by in the Andrew Jackson presidency. But even before that, the in 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision in there were several Cherokee cases where the Cherokee Nation was suing the state of Georgia. And also some individual settlers who had illegally squatted on their land, started plantations, and the state of Georgia was trying to annex the part of the Cherokee Nation that was in Georgia, and so they sued, and the Supreme Court under Justice John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, affirmed the doctrine of discovery. So he said that it was an established principle, European law and English law in effect in Britain's North American colonies, and was also now the law of the United States. So that court defined it, you know, distilled it exactly what it meant in application by the United States that exclusive property rights that a European country acquires by discovery, and this is quoting, discovery gave title to the government by whose subjects or by whose authority it was made against all other European governments, and the title was consummated by possession. So he continued that the Supreme Court said, in no instance are the indigenous nations' rights entirely disregarded, but were necessarily to a considerable event impaired. And so he said that the rights to complete sovereignty of independent nations were diminished. And he claimed that indigenous people, because of the bounty of the United States and their generosity, could continue to live on the land, but the title resided with the United States. And he finalized that decision by creating a new category in human history that applied only to Native people, domestic dependent nations. Well, in fact, very soon after, in Andrew Jackson's presidency, he pushed through the Indian Removal Act, and that dissolved all of the Native nations east of the Mississippi River, and all the citizens were forced to relocate in Indian Territory.
Right.
And then later, Indian Territory was dissolved and became a part of the state of Oklahoma. So this is still the law. This is the relationship law between the United States government and Native nations. It's a colonial relationship based on the doctrine of discovery. So that harks back to Columbus Day, that is a celebration, a opening the wound every year that these are dependent peoples forever and ever, and that can never be changed. And so that is what has to go. And so I think many of us see doing away with Columbus Day or renaming it Indigenous Peoples Day as
right.
A very solemn day of mourning and not a celebration necessarily, of Indigenous peoples, but yeah, their survival. But to really be able to then have teachers be able to form units of teaching about what really happened, rather than having to focus on Columbus and then negate, because that's very hard for a public school teacher, especially with school boards that are conservative and right-wing ones, and like where I come from in Oklahoma and Texas, that they would get fired, but it would give them the ability to, to tell the truth to students, which they usually know. I know a lot of school teachers, they cannot just do that unless they have some kind of pass, and that's why it's important to get rid of that day of celebration of Columbus.
Well, I still have so many questions, and we're actually tragically running out of time. But where do we go?
Can I tell you that there's a petition on the whitehouse.gov petition function on whitehouse.gov.
Mm-hmm.
They have a pretty nice thing where you can post petitions and get
right.
signatures. And we have one up there for changing Columbus Day holiday, so people can go to it. petitions.whitehouse.gov/petition/change Columbus Day holiday. But there'll be a list of them. People can find it.
I'll definitely put that link on the newsletter for the show. I'll find it and put the link down so people can go ahead and sign that. And I guess Seattle, the city council officially recognized that recently.
They did. And, Minneapolis and Denver already had done that.
Mm-hmm.
And South Dakota, thanks to the Lakota work on it, South Dakota as a state renamed that day Native American Day. And then several states with large Native populations in the West have simply don't observe Columbus Day. They just,
right.
Of course, the post offices are closed,
right.
And you know the federal it's still a federal holiday whether the states recognize it or not. But at least they've made that gesture to not observe it.
Well, let's talk about, since we're talking about like the struggle and meaning, how is it meaningful for today? If there was no indigenous resistance, there might have been a complete genocide of our indigenous people here in what became the United States. But you already mentioned Palestine, which was a question that I wanted to ask you. Is that a settler colonialism is a genocidal policy, you wrote. And then you quoted somebody, I'm not sure who, that had written, the notion that settler-indigenous conflict is an inevitable product of cultural differences and misunderstanding, or that violence was committed equally by the colonized and colonizer, blur the historical process. And to me, that just like shouts out what's happening in Palestine right now with, Israel claiming like eternal victim status because the people they're trying to colonize resist. But this also is very relevant to the term Redskins, because when we look at old cowboy and Indian movies, it's always the, it's always the savage who's what's that called? Scalping the settlers, but really the atrocities were committed on the indigenous people by the colonizers. And why, what is Redskin? Why do we use that term Redskin?
Well, first, it's easily observable that Native Americans do not have red skin.
Mm-hmm.
Only white people who get sunburned have red skin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, it really doesn't come from skin color. So then you have to ask, well, what does it come from? So this is where it comes from. During the Pequot War, I'm going to read this little passage. During the Pequot War, Connecticut and Massachusetts colonial officials had offered bounties, initially for the heads of murdered indigenous people, and later for their scalps, which were more portable in large numbers. This is, this was in the early 17th century. But scalp hunting became routine only in the mid-1670s following an incident on the northern frontier of the Massachusetts colony. The practice began in earnest in 1697 when settler Hannah Dustin, having murdered 10 of her Abenaki captors in a nighttime escape, presented their 10 scalps to the Massachusetts General Assembly and was rewarded with bounties for 2 men, 2 women, and 6 children. Be wondering why she had to kill those 6 children, right?
All right.
sounds like massacre. But
mm-hmm.
Anyway, she, her statue's all over Massachusetts and everything. She's a folk hero. But the settler authorities then hit upon a way to encourage settlers to take off on their own or with a few others to gather scalps at random for reward money. So it didn't even have to be in wartime, or any kind of conflict. Just kill, an Indian walking down the road and make money off of it. So military historian John Grenier says, in the process, they established a large-scale privatization of war within American frontier communities. And the colonial government raised the bounty for adult male scalps. They actually lowered it for females and eliminated it for indigenous children under 10. But, with scalps, it's almost impossible to tell the age and gender.
Right.
victims. So that was, you know, really not applicable. The scalp hunter could take children captive, however, and sell them into slavery, which also, you know, was profit-making.
Mm-hmm.
These practices erased any remaining distinction between indigenous combatants and non-combatants and induced a market for indigenous slaves. Bounties for indigenous scalps were honored even in the absence of war. Scalps and indigenous children became means of exchange or currency, and this development even created a black market. Scalp hunting was not only a profitable privatized enterprise, but also a means to eradicate or subjugate the indigenous population of the Anglo-American Atlantic seaboard. The settlers gave a name to the mutilated and bloody corpses they left in the wake of scalping, redskins.
So you were talking about this movement to not have a celebration of Columbus Day in 1992 that energized indigenous populations around the world and your allies also. But this whole Washington Redskin thing is doing the same thing today.
Yes, it's traumatizing, you know.
I guess so. Jeez.
Yeah, Native Americans love football. I was just in Washington, D.C., and, you know, all my Native friends there, they would love to support Washington.
Uh-huh.
And they'd love to be able to take their children there, but, you know, they can't. It basically excludes them because it's so racist. And I've come to think that they're subconsciously, at least, the people, who support the maintenance of that name actually do know what it means. I mean, they've been told plenty of times, but they say it's honoring Native people.
Right. That's such an honor, isn't it?
But I think it's just, you know, there's a sense of victory, you know, it's the same as, you know, how they think about Muslims now or terrorists. And it's meant to be in their face, you know, that this is what the United States is built on, is this victory over the indigenous populations. And they quite often exaggerate Native war abilities. Most Native people were farmers.
Right.
They didn't have armies. You know, why would they need armies? They were farmers. Agriculturalists, fishermen, you know, they didn't have armies. They were like the Vietnamese, you know, peasants didn't have an army until they formed the guerrilla army. And so, yeah, they formed guerrilla resistance and did arm themselves. But it's so, you know, in fact, most European colonialism attacked people without means of resistance. They did not
have
to fight back initially, and that's how they were able to get the upper hand.
That was true then, and it's true today.
Exactly. Same thing today.
Unfortunately. And then you mentioned how today in the U.S. military, if you're going to a hostile, what they call a hostile territory, which is, you know, anywhere the U.S. wants to subjugate with their military empire, they call it going to Indian country. And then they have shortened it to in country. That is something that I didn't know. That was something I learned from your book. I knew they would say in country, we're going in country, but it's short for Indian country.
You know, that first Gulf War, it imprinted on people so many of the military terminology, militarization of our vocabulary, the collateral damage, and in country became, of course, they were using Indian country too, and I heard it on TV quite a bit, but mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there were enough complaints from the National Congress, American Indian, they had always also shortened it to in country, the military had. But now I hear Rachel Maddow even. She constantly says in country. Oh, you're going in country. You know, talk about going to Afghanistan or something.
Right.
And I think can someone tell her, you know, what she's saying? I mean, would she say it if she knew it meant Indian country? I don't know. You know, it becomes so naturalized. That's the thing that just drives you crazy,
right,
you know,
with
things about Native people, because this erasure and then this whole colonial mentality built up around it, that it's just like an Indian behind every bush. You know, people still say that. They still say off the reservation, meaning, you know, a wild Indian,
mm-hmm.
a wild person. These phrases are, you know, just thrown out without second thought.
Well, I also like Indian giver, which is like totally hypocritical, because the U.S. has broken every single treaty or promise it made with our indigenous population.
Yeah, Indian giver is really, really ironic, because it means that you're double dealing, you
right.
know, sort of like the term for Jews of being shyster, you know, this, and people use that still. Or jipping someone, and that's Indian giver. And, you know, it's just that they would come and, you know, take land, and then the Indians fought back, and so they're taking back their territory, so they're Indian givers.
That's crazy.
They just say, okay, you take it. No, that's the most ironic of all. And we use it a lot. Actually, there's a wonderful book called Indian Givers, and it's about, you know, everything that Native people produced, all the agricultural products and the canoes and, you know, the parkas and all of these different kinds of architecture and everything. So he uses it as a giving, you know, to humanity. It changes the term, but yeah, you still hear it quite a bit. Consciousness is being raised, not as much as in Canada.
Yes.
I've gone there quite a few times, and you know about the I Don't Know More.
Right. I wanted to chat about that.
We did a little slice of it here, you know,
uh-huh.
and it just traveled all over the world, but they have such an infrastructure of allies there, including the very well organized immigrant population. And No One Is Illegal. It's an incredible organization that supports Native rights and really, really show up. You know, and we just don't have that on the left in the United States at all.
Well, hopefully your book will be an advancement of that conversation and that energy, and that goes perfectly with my final question. I did want to talk about you know, Andrew Jackson and James Fenimore Cooper, Daniel Boone, who I am ashamed to say I'm a distant ancestor of, and you know, the myth of the American founding or what do you call it, the origin history of the United States. I wanted to talk about the ghost dance. So hopefully I can rebook you soon, and we'll talk about those things, because those are so important. But this is my final question for you, and it goes with what you were just talking about. Here in the United States, we have a lot of struggles going on. You know, we have the peace movement, which is a lot smaller now that we have a Democrat in office that's doing the wars. We have, you know, against police violence. We have against Monsanto, where, you know, have all of these movements going on. But it's been my experience, you know, since my son was killed, that most of the people in these movements, or, you know, leading these movements, or the proto leaders of these movements, are Scots-Irish or ancestors of other European colonizers. And so how can we recognize this? So this is the perfect last question. So what you were talking about, when I go to Canada, or when I've been down to Australia, the people on the left that have invited me there, and Hawaii also, I must say, the people who invite me there, they recognize that they are on stolen land. They recognize
mm-hmm.
that they are the ancestors of the colonizers, and they always include the local, you know, indigenous group to ask permission to use the facility that we're on, to have a welcoming ceremony for us, and to give the blessing for the gathering. And, you know, that's not a perfect solution to recognizing that we are the colonists who are trying to reform a system that we created. And how can we include more as leaders of these movements and as partners in these movements, the indigenous struggles and the activism?
Yeah, it's also in Latin America that's happening, that process, and it's
yes.
it's such a sea change from.
And there are indigenous leaders in Latin America.
Yes, Evo Morales.
Right.
And here it's going to be really tough because I don't think people on the left, they have so worked out in the last century of various struggles, union struggles, and then through the civil rights struggle and the women's rights struggle, disabled, now in the climate change movement that's very large. But I think it got hardened, a certain perspective on the United States that it was, and this is really Howard Zinn's view too, and why I was always arguing with him about, mm-hmm. That he maintained the kernel of the origin story of a now imperfect union, sort of like LinkedIn. It's imperfect, let's make it more perfect.
Mm-hmm.
As if it's a normal republic, that did some bad, a few bad things.
Right.
And, corrected them as they mm-hmm. go along. And so I think it's very hard to shake that on the left. I don't think other countries had that kind of hardened, decisive, this is the way, the alternative history. And I think it cripples our movements because...
I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
It certainly, if you look at Israel, that Peace Now and other, anti-Israeli aggression policies never either deeply rooted themselves in the concept of settler colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And it has limited, their, it's kind of a mirror image, of the United States in many ways, and much to learn, mostly negatively from.
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, I learned a lot. I worked in the anti-apartheid movement beginning in 1964 at UCLA because there were a lot of South African exiles, fellow students, and I got involved in that, and I learned so much from them about how the Calvinist context and the origin story, how important that is,
mm-hmm.
how the Calvinists in South Africa, just like in Massachusetts, thought they were forming a new Zion, a new Jerusalem, and that God gave them that land.
Mm-hmm.
And not only the right, but the obligation to possess it and do away with the savages, the devil, incarnate. So it's so similar. I said, wow, that really rings a bell. That's actually when I started... Uh-huh. Building my own thesis about the United States.
Well, hopefully I can have you on again soon, and maybe around Thanksgiving time we can have a conversation about that, because the origin myth is so important, and like you said, that's why the left can't move past that, because of that origin myth that we have going on. And you point out in your book that we're not responsible for the past, but we're responsible for the conditions that we're in today. And
right.
we can make those conditions better. But we can't do it unless we recognize that past and, have some kind of, have some truth. We have to expose the truth and then start to reconcile it.
Yeah, we have to get out of this majoritarian mentality that numbers are the only thing that counts.
Right.
Even the left does that, they're not large numbers, like Native Americans, they're not large numbers, a constituency, then, it's it is a birth decide is not an issue to be brought up because it alienates others, you know. And so that's a part of the problem, I think, is that capitalistic counting system right. that's always there rather than what's at the core.
Well, how can we break this cycle of militarism and war and empire if we don't like recognize the roots of it and heal those roots? It's like we're constantly trapped in this horrible karma of violence.
Exactly. It's like Richard Slotkin is great, who wrote this book, Regeneration Through Violence, he calls it.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote three trilogy, and the last one's called Gunfighter Nation. They're really important, you know, really important trilogy. But he actually says that there is this repeat, you know, it's almost like, well, it didn't turn, it's never enough, you know, to keep winning.
Right.
And it's that paranoid streak in the settler class in the United States, you know, that thinks they're surrounded by enemies all the time, when it's a phantom. But they were surrounded by people on the land, you know, who actually were the stewards of the land. They were surrounded, and they were not willing to assimilate into those cultures. That would have been fine.
Right.
These people are always assimilating people into their cultures. No problem, you know. They had all kinds of exchanges with one another. So that would have been possible had that been the intention of those people coming. But so there's a deep-seated guilt that people won't deal, you know, just can't deal with, I think. And even immigrants, they're a little immune to it, at least the first generation, but the next generation starts understanding, you know, this kind of discomfort of being in the settler class, you know. So I think immigrants are very important, too, for understanding this history.
Well, Roxanne, we ran out of time 10 minutes ago. So,
okay.
Thank you so much for your time, and I hopefully you can post this interview at Facebook, and we will for our newsletter and the posting about this show, we'll have all those relevant links. So, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, thank you so much for giving us being so generous with your time and with this book, and I'll write a review about it too, because I couldn't recommend it more. It's just
great.
It's just really fabulous, and thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and again, I really hope that we are able to talk soon.
Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's the Soapbox for today. As always, I hope you were educated and motivated to learn more or to do something. And I'm looking forward to having Dr. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz join me on the Soapbox so we can continue this conversation about this very important history that is relevant, as relevant today as it was 400 or 500 years ago. So as always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank Dr. Dunbar Ortiz for writing this book and giving us her time today. And as always, I'd especially like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.